Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPATrendlines.com, now available on iTunes. CPA Trendlines presents an episode of The Disruptors.
Welcome to Accounting Disruptor Conversations. I'm your host, Liz Farr from CPA Trendlines, and we have a treat for you today. My guest today is Ron Baker, founder of Verisage Institute, co-host of the Soul of Enterprise podcast, and author of The Firm of the Future, Implementing Value Pricing, Measure What Matters, and a new book, Time's Up, the Subscription Business Model for Professional Firms. How are you today, Ron?
I'm great, Liz. So great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. You know, and I got to say, Ron, that your work has had a big impact on me. It was really a ray of hope for me when I was trapped in a cubicle in a dead-end accounting firm. And it was the ray of light that showed me that there are ways out of the billable hour hell that we have created.
That's awesome, because I feel the same way. The journey, that's what started the journey. I was also trying to get out of that darkness that we were all in under the old model, because I've been doing timesheets since I've been in high school, when I had my own accounting firm and was doing taxes and, you know, people's books. And it's crazy. So it was a lot of unlearning.
Yeah. Well, in today's show, instead of going over the usual questions that I ask everyone, we're going to switch gears and we are going to talk about Ron's new book, Time's Up. Now, this new book presents a new business model for accounting firms, the subscription model. Can you briefly explain what this is?
Yeah, you know, it's called by Tien Tzuo, the founder of Zora, CEO and founder of Zora, which is a software platform that runs subscription businesses. He's coined the term subscription economy, which I kind of like. And it's projected to grow to $1.5 trillion by 2025. Just to put that in context, it's about $650 billion in 2020. So we've been trying to keep track on our radio show how many things we can subscribe to. And I can't keep track of it anymore. I've lost track. I mean, I can subscribe to a home. I can subscribe to a boat from Brunswick. And you can subscribe to Porsche. In fact, a fleet of Porsches, Porsche Drive. And I just see this tsunami out there in the economy that all these businesses are offering subscription, and it's really a way to surface simplicity for your customer, to provide a more convenient, frictionless experience, to provide peace of mind, to plus the offering. You can't, with subscription, this is what makes it a business model change, not just a pricing change, is you have to go to the market with a plus offering. An enhanced offering, because after all, if we just go to the market with the same offering as everybody else, we're going to command common prices. But if we go to the market with an uncommon offering, then we have some room for some pricing power and uncommon pricing. So I think that's really exciting. And there's no doubt in my mind that this is going to be the new model for the firm of the future. And that's kind of how we came to write this book, because the publisher asked us if we wanted to do a 20-year update on the firm of the future that Paul Dunn and I, who we wrote that book together, was published in 2003, and we published this book in 2023, even though it came out in November. So it's kind of, and I said, no, I don't want to update the old book. I want to write a new book. When I proposed this model, they loved it. So I'm really excited about it, because I think this is the new frontier for our profession.
I agree. And I have heard of lots of accounting firms who were at least dipping their toe in the water of trying this out. So I think that this is going to be a lot of big changes for the profession. I really do.
I do too. And, you know, yeah. It kind of started from my obsession with two questions, basically. One was, what would happen if Disney started CPA firms? And when you pose that question to people. You say, would they treat it like a commodity? Would they treat it like a grudge purchase? Would they price it low because it's a grudge purchase and it's a commodity? No, they would enhance the experience and you would pay a fortune and you would be delighted to do so. Well, Liz, why do we have to wait for Disney to start CPA firms? Why don't we up the game ourselves and stop looking at one another and benchmarking one another? I don't want to benchmark my peers. I want to go out and benchmark Disney and Nordstrom and FedEx and Lexus and find out what these companies are doing and Amazon to up their game. And I think that's what this model forces you to do.
Yeah, oh, I agree. Now, are there other professions who are using this model successfully?
Yes, this has got an incredible empirical track record. And this was my North Star writing the book, was it concierge doctors. The first concierge doctor was started by a guy named Howard Moran, who was the Seattle Sonics basketball team doctor. And he was a general physician. And he said, you know, hey, when one of my players gets hurt on the court in a game, I can go out there and I know everything about these guys. I know their medical history. I know what drugs they take. I know what they're allergic to, blah, 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 blah. He knows everything about them. I can get them back in the game real quick. Why can't I do that with my patients? And that was his question. Don't all great things start with a question? Without a good question, there's no place for an answer to go. And he started MD Squared, which today is the largest concierge medical practice in the country, with multiple, you know, lots of different offices across the country. It was even international at one point, but they scaled back, I guess, because the different countries have different medical systems. Right. Anyway, he started this, and the philosophy was, we're going to have one doctor handle 50 families, and that's it.
Wow.
And the average general physician, just to put that in context, has a panel of patients of 2,400 patients. So this is why we get to spend 5 minutes with our doctor. And half that time, they're staring in front of their, you know, laptop to type into your electronic health records. Well, the concierge doctors don't do any of that. They don't take insurance. They don't have medical billers and coders. They've eliminated all the bureaucracy. You subscribe to them directly. Now, concierge doctors go after the top 5%, top 10% of income earners in the country. They're going after CEOs, people that basically have more money than time. His initial price was something like 24 grand a year for a couple, and it was like 4 grand per kid. And again, they max out at 50 families. But that means they would do home visits, they would do office visits. If you got sick overseas, sometimes they'd fly to you and coordinate your care overseas or bring you back. There's no waiting rooms in these doctors' offices because they have capacity to always handle emergencies. And when was MD Squared founded? 1996.
Wow.
And I wrote about this in the book, and I said, we didn't even have a good vocabulary to explain this type of medicine. You know what I called it? I wrote a book called Pricing on Purpose in 2004 or five or something, because I had run across MD Squared in 2000. So I was 4 years behind when it started, when I learned about it. And then in 2005, I called it, well, this is retainer-based medicine. Talking about, you know, how we tend to describe the new by going back to the old, you know, the automobile, the horseless carriage, Bitcoin, the digital wallet. There's no wallet in Bitcoin, but, you know, that's what we do. We don't even have an adequate vocabulary for this model, but it's not a retainer because they're not working off anything. In fact, I met the bookkeeper who set up MD Square on QuickBooks, basically. And she said, I used to go to the controller with a check, you know, $3,000 check, whatever the monthly amount was, and say, where do I code this? What did we do for this patient? And the guy said, we did whatever the patient required. I don't know what we did. That's not why he's paying us the $3,000. He's paying the $3,000 for access to us when he needs us.
Right.
And I thought, oh, geez, this is a completely different model. So after the concierge doctors came out and some physicians transferred to that, then the DPC doctors, the direct primary care doctors, started to hit the market, and they're at a different price point. So they go down even below middle class. Mm-hmm. We interviewed one guy, and he deals in Detroit. He's in Detroit, and he's $100 a month. Mm-hmm. And he's a GP, which means they can handle 60-80% of your health needs. And the reason I spend so much time in the book, I have a chapter on both concierge, but more on DPC, is because people who entered the medical profession, became a doctor, did so to help people. Liz, you can't help people if you have 2,400 patients. I don't care how good you are. You're not helping people. You may be helping them get well, you know, from what they present with when they come in to see, but you're not keeping them healthy. You're not doing all you could for it. You can't have deep transformative experiences with them. And this is part of what I love about this model is even DPC docs limit themselves to 600 patients. And I think we need to do the same thing, because when I ask CPAs, why did you join this profession? To help people. You can't help people if you have 1,000 customers. I don't care how good you are. You're not helping anybody. You're complying, you're helping them comply, but you're not doing all the things that we could be doing for them. So I think this gets us back to our roots of why did we join this profession? I didn't join this profession to do the most tax returns, to bill the most hours, to have the most clients. I didn't do any of it. I don't want any of that. I want to have deep, meaningful impacts and deep, meaningful relationships with the customers I'm privileged to serve. And I can't do that if I have too many of them.
I completely agree. You know, there were so many times when I was still practicing that I saw there was so much more that we could have done for some of our clients, but we just didn't have the time or the bandwidth. We just didn't.
Yep. That's because we take on every customer. We try and be all things to all people. And we try and be Morton's and McDonald's and a vegan restaurant all in one, because we don't want to turn anybody away. And you can't do that. You know, we can't please everybody. We're not tequila. We have to pick a, we have to focus and really bear down on what we can do. Because I think from a strategic perspective, CPA firms, in fact, I'd say all businesses, are defined by the customers they don't have and the services they don't perform. So these doctors are general physicians, which means they are not going to do cardiac surgery. They're not going to replace your hip. They're not going to cure your cancer. But what they will do is they will bring you to an oncologist or a heart surgeon, and they will sit in an appointment with you, and they will make sure that care is coordinated, just like CPAs do when they meet with the attorney and the financial advisor and the insurance guy and, you know, down the line. Well, that's what they do, and that's what we could be doing. Doctors keep us physically healthy. CPAs should be keeping their customers financially healthy, because both our health and our wealth are worth investing in. It's not a commodity. It's the farthest thing from a commodity I can think of, is your health and your wealth. Healthy, wealthy, and wise. Now, wise is education and all of that, but we can do something about the wealth, and that decommoditizes us right out of the gate.
Yeah. Now, one of my favorite quotes in your book has to do with time, because, you know, when I first started public accounting, what I was told is we sell time. We sell hours. That is what we sell. You know, that was what I was told. And one of my favorite quotes in here is about time. It's on page 185. We also need to stop thinking about time as somehow equated to value or even cost. It's not. Time is a constraint. You cannot sell it, store it, hoard it, trade it, or buy more of it. All businesses, indeed all living things, are constrained by time. Your business model should not be. Now, how does this relate to the subscription model?
Well, what's great about subscription model, and I think why we called the book Time's Up, is this is it for time. If this doesn't get firms to move away from the billable hour thinking and the timesheet recording, which I've always been against, even with value pricing, then nothing will. Because subscription is a different business model. And when you change a business model, two things change at least, if not more. But at least these two things always change. And I mean radically change. One is your pricing strategy. So we go from buying a $20 CDs to buying a dollar a song, putting it on our iPod, and now we're all streaming music.
Yeah.
So different pricing strategy. And I can go we can go down the list. We can talk about Uber surge pricing versus taxi cab. We can talk about Airbnb and their pricing is different. The other thing that changes, and most consultants and change agents don't understand this, and I've never understood why, but when you change a business model, your KPIs change. Everything you look at internally changes. Your dashboard is, I promise you, Airbnb's dashboard does not look like Hilton's. And and Uber's does not look like a taxi cab company. And in subscription, one of the great things about it, because there's so many businesses out there that are subscription based, and in fact, most unicorns are subscription based, we have an incredible amount of empirical evidence on what metrics and KPIs make sense for subscription. Andreessen Horowitz has got two reports that are absolutely amazing, because they pull open the kimono and they say, this is the these are the metrics that we look at to evaluate, invest in, and purchase subscription-based businesses. And they're phenomenal. Every KPI you could ever dream of is in there. And not one of them has anything to do with time.
Right. They all have to do with the customer value. Now, I write for a couple of accounting tech companies, and they're all subscription-based. So they're talking about CAC and, you know, lifetime customer value, LCV, and recurring revenue, and churn, and all of those things. And so I had to learn what all those things were so that I could understand what they were talking about, what was important to them.
Yep. The income statement starts with beginning ARR, annual recurring revenue, and it backs out churn, and then it classifies expenses differently, because it's no longer about matching, Liz. We have a fetish as accountants about matching. It's not about matching. Even if Apple were to go to fully subscription, they couldn't match iPhone's computer. They couldn't match the SKU to the subscriber, because it's not about that. It's about growing the lifetime value of the subscriber, not about piling on services or products brick by brick by brick, thinking we're going to make more profit. That we've got a different profit formula with the subscription business model. It's completely different. And so when people, we get pushback on this all the time, as you can imagine. Well, what about the one-off? What about this project? What about that? No, it's got a different profit formula. You're what you're doing with subscription is you're building lifetime annuities that are worth far more than the cost to acquire them. And that's the new profit formula. And that bakes into that profit formula, by the way, that when you have a firm to sell, when you're ready to sell or exit, your firm is going to be valued higher if it's got annual recurring revenue as opposed to just reoccurring revenue. There's a huge difference between reoccurring and annual recurring revenue. One is definitely repeatable. It's more predictable, especially if you have a track record of churn. You know how many customers on average you're losing. Reoccurring revenue, that's kind of like a rash. You never know when it's going to come back. We do a lot of one and done projects that we probably shouldn't do, by the way. The last thing I want to hear from my heart surgeon is, wow, look at that. I've never seen that before. I think that's a violation of due care, by the way. Forget how you price a project that doesn't fit into normally what we do. My question, should we be doing it at all? Are you a GP trying to do heart surgery? You're not doing yourself any favors, but you're certainly not doing your customer any favors if you step outside of your area of expertise. Plus, it's unprofessional. Look up due care. That's why I quote the AICPA due care principle in the book in its totality, because it's so forceful about, if you don't have experience doing this, you shouldn't do it. It's a violation of your professional duty. It's one of the core six principles of the AICPA code of principles. And I think we do that a lot, because we don't want to say no to anything.
No.
And it would be like GP doing heart surgery. It just wouldn't be right. So anyway, it's a different profit formula. It's also a different revenue model. And the revenue model question is really interesting, because The revenue model question asks, I think, an incredibly important question that we tend not to focus on is, what do we want our customers to pay us for? Now, right. If you look at hourly billing, even if you look at value pricing, what are our customers paying us for? Basically a scope of work. Mm-hmm. Even if we value price it, even if we offer three options, it's those options are differentiated based on scope of work. So it could be size of business, could be number of employees, all these things. And that leads us to believe that the more services we stack up brick by brick by brick, the more value that we're adding. And that's not the case at all, because the services are just a means to an end.
Right.
The end is the outcome, or what we call in the book a transformation. And that's where you're at the highest point of value, is when you guide your customers through transformations. And we can do that as CPAs serially. We can do it over and over and over again, from womb to tomb, you know, from college planning to estate planning, literally. And we don't use this language. We don't communicate our value this way. We talk about efforts and services and scope of work. And, oh, if you're out of scope, if the scope changes, we have to go to the Department of Paperwork and get a change request and then get a change order signed off. But, I mean, let's stop this. We need to up our game. We need to up the customer experience and stop putting our customers through, this paperwork morass. I mean, sending them 200-page organizers and making them do change requests and having a value conversation every year so you can price them. No. Separate the cognitive load of the pricing decision from the work that we do. Once they make a decision to subscribe to us, then they're covered for whatever we can do, just like the concierge docs. And that gives them convenience. It gives them peace of mind. They know we'll be there when they need us for whatever we can do. That's the scope limitation, what we can do professionally, our due care. I'll give you a real quick example of this. I called my eye surgeon back in October because I needed a new eye exam because my prescription had lapsed. They expire after 2 years, and I needed a new pair of glasses. And I called him October 1st. He couldn't see me until January 29th. Now, and I love this doctor. He's an eye surgeon. He's brilliant. I love him. If he told me to play in the traffic, I would. But here's the thing. If he's going to do that to me, then he now has become expendable in my life. He hasn't become indispensable. He's become expendable. I'm going to give him one more shot. I'm going to go see him in January, and I'm going to read him the Riot Act. I'm going to say, Doc, you have too many patients. And unless you give me an option to subscribe to you where I can cut in front of the line and see you within 24 hours, I'm out of here. I'm out of here. You are wasting my time. And in today's world, the largest sin that we commit, any business commits, is to waste their customers' time. If we are going to track time in this profession, there's two things we should track. We should track the time that our customers spend with us, and we should track the time that we save them.
Yes.
Because if we can do that, then you can name your price.
Absolutely.
I really believe that.
Yeah, I think so too. Now, for years, you've been preaching the glories of value pricing. And how is the subscription model better than value pricing?
Well, again, it's got a different profit formula. And people that teach value pricing get all hung up on this. Oh, no, you've got to maximize the transaction. And you've got to maximize the price that you're, optimize the price that you're getting. All, very sustainable business models, all quite rational, but the subscription model's got a different profit formula. So what we're trying to do here is grow lifetime customer value, which means we're constantly plussing our offering. We're constantly innovating, just like Amazon Prime and Netflix are constantly giving us new content. Notice how the price doesn't change when they do that. Mm-hmm. There's no correlation anymore between the work and the price. We're disconnecting that. And we're trying to grow lifetime customer value. So that's different. There's no more scope creep under this model because there's no more scope. We do whatever the customer needs when they need it on demand. And because we have fewer customers, we always have capacity. The last thing you want to hear from your eye surgeon or your dentist it with a bad toothache is, no, I'll see you in 2 weeks, Ron. You better be able to fit me in within an hour, or you have become dispensable. Period. To me, this is a no-brainer. If you're wasting the customer's time like that, it just shows you have no respect for your customer's time. And a lot of people, Liz, have more money than time, especially mm-hmm. customers of CPAs. When they need something, they want it. And mm-hmm. the reason they can't get it on demand is because we have too many customers.
We definitely do. You know, I remember, you know, I started out at H&R Block, and we would do a tax return every 20 minutes. So I think in 1 year, I signed 600 tax returns. Just me, all by my lonesome.
It's suicide.
Yeah.
And then we wonder why this profession eats its young and why we can't attract talent. Because we're giving them rote work that is not challenging. We're giving them stuff that you don't need a CPA to do. I'm not going to mention specifics, but you can imagine. I mean, the biggest sin you can do on the side of a professional firm is to have a surgeon pierce an ear. Right. And there are a lot of surgeons piercing ears in CPA firms. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. not why I joined this profession. I joined this profession to help people. And when you structure a firm around subscription and you're offering, or I should say guiding, when you're guiding these transformations, when you're taking the customer from where they are to where they want to be, some desired future state, that's a transformation. Now, we can only guide those. We can't coerce a customer to transform into something they don't want to do. They have to select it. We just guide the process. So it could be and it sounds grandiose, I know, but it doesn't have to be. It could be as simple as, we're going to plan to get your kid into college. Now, mm-hmm. not academically, but financially, we can help with, we're going to help you retire sooner. We're going to help you grow your business so you can, you know, buy a second home or have more money or more time with your family. You know, we can help plan your legacy for those who do estate. I mean, does Mark Zuckerberg and Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, do they put some time and thought and money into their legacy?
Sure,
can you imagine the billions they spend on lawyers and CPAs to help them plan for when they leave this mortal coil? We do that, but how do we talk about it in terms of outputs? Oh, we'll do the trust agreement. We'll do the trust act. No, those are means to an end. The end is the transformation. It's touching the customer's soul. So here's the cool thing about transformations. When you guide a transformation, the customer's the product.
Yeah.
It's transformation as a service. It's TaaS. That's really what we're doing. It's not about stacking up services brick by brick. Oh, and the more scope and blah, blah, blah. No, none of that's valuable to the customer. So just as it's bad, I think, to be on a hours for dollars treadmill, I think being on a service for dollars treadmill is just as bad. Now we can really do what we were born to do as CPAs, which is to guide people to a desired future state. Is there anything more powerful than that? That's the apotheosis of value. It doesn't get any higher here. You know, Porsche can't do that. Yeah, they can sell me a car, or I can subscribe to a Porsche. And yes, that can get me over my midlife crisis, and it can, you know, make my neighbors jealous. But it's not going to have the same transformative impact that CPAs can provide, because we're not restricted by a product. We work with our minds. We can guide our customers. It's not about doing services, selling our hands. It's sometimes just about asking better questions. And it doesn't always require us to do service. I think if we scaled back on the services that we provided, we'd probably be more valuable to our customers. I think some of the stuff we do for them is they don't see any value in it. But it's something we can count and measure and, you know, scope out so we can, but that's not how we should be pricing.
I completely agree with that, because I think back to a couple of clients I worked with, a couple of customers who had some kind of exit plan for their business on the horizon. But because helping them get to that desired state wasn't really in the scope of work. We couldn't really find it on our list of services. It wasn't in the tax return. We were kind of helpless to do that. And it really kind of haunts me that there are these people who we really kind of missed the boat with, that really needed more than we could give them at the time.
How many times do we hear that this profession is relationship-based? I hear it constantly. We want to be your trusted advisor. We want to be, you know, whatever terms we use. But when you look at our business model, what are we monetizing? We're monetizing the services and the scope of work.
Right.
We are so much more than the sum of our scope of work. And we have to get over this idea that it's about piling on services brick by brick. I want to monetize the relationship, not the transaction. I want to stop looking at the math of the moment and focus on the long-term customer value, lifetime customer value. Because once a customer signs up to a subscription and they stay for 1 year, you've got a 90% plus probability of keeping them for life. Those are the types of customers I want, because I can have deep, meaningful relationships with them, just like that team doctor did with his NBA players. And just like these doctors do with their patients.
Yeah. Now, and we've talked about why transformation is more valuable than providing services. And now I want to switch gear a little bit and look at, what would an accounting firm that uses the subscription model, what would one of these look like?
Well, in my model, again, is the direct primary care doctors or the concierge doctors, there would be constant innovation. Now, I don't mean, you know, you're going to come out with a new iPad or a new service or 10 new services every year, but you would plus the offering. So, for example, a lot of these DPC docs will add things like, they'll say, oh, now we offer 23andMe analysis, you know, DNA type thing. Or we have a nutritionist that we work with to help you with your diet, or we have a chiropractor who can do treatments, or we've opened up a pharmacy. So now you can get your prescriptions fulfilled here with us. And all of these things never change the price. They add these things. That way, when they do increase their price, whether that's annually or every couple of years, whatever, just like Amazon sent out an email to their Prime members this year when they increased their Prime subscription price, They didn't blame it on inflation. They didn't blame it on raising costs or higher labor costs or minimum wages or supply chain problems. They said, we've added value in the following ways. And they gave you like 10 bullet points. You know, we've added more same cities of same day delivery, you know, 90 some odd cities. Mm-hmm. Now, even if you're not in one of those cities, you're going, oh, well, that's going to come to me. And we've added Thursday night football, and we've added these Kindle benefits and magazines and music and new shows and blah. Even if I don't access any of it, it's still throw a halo over the entire value proposition of staying subscribed to Amazon. And that's one of the ways it looks different, because it's constantly innovating, which also gives the team members a chance to innovate and use their brains rather than just rotely following checklists and doing the same work over and over. They can actually say, hey, I learned about this killer app or read this incredible business book. Why don't we bring this to our customers and start a conversation? We don't do stuff like that. Why? One, we're too busy. Two, that, like you said, there's no code on the timesheet for it. There's, you know, we don't sell the service, so where do I code? Well, we're not selling a service. We're selling access and knowledge and ideas. And I think that would be, it would restore us to living our purpose of why we entered this profession. So I see it as a more dynamic firm, because the talent you're attracting, that's what they want to do. I don't want to do the same thing for 5 years over and over. I want to kind of have diversity of helping my clients get to a preferred future. Because the other thing about this that I find fascinating is we talk a lot in this profession about solving problems. And we are great problem solvers. We got tax issues, we get the IRS off your back, you know, we can catch you up on your compliance, all of these things. It's always going to be a part of what we do, no doubt about it. The problem is, if all we're doing for our customers is solving problems, we're just reverting them back to the status quo. We are right. not progressing them. And the future right. is in progressing the customer, not in just solving their problems. It's helping them transform into a new person. Because when you offer a transformation, they become a new person. Like the historian Herodotus said, you can't step in the same river twice, because not only has the river changed, but you've changed. That's what a transformation is. And boy, is that not a commodity. That's, it doesn't get any higher value than that.
Yeah, now I've heard of a couple of firms who are saying, well, we're doing it by subscriptions. So the price that we charge you for your tax return, let's say, is $1,200. So you pay us $100 a month and we'll do your tax return. And oh, and if you need other stuff, well, we may need to add something to the agreement, or we may have to charge for that on an hourly basis. So I think there's a lot of confusion out there about what it really means to follow the subscription-based model.
You're so right. I can't tell you how many firms say to me, oh, we do subscription, take the annual price and divide by 12. That's a pricing payment term right. relationship. It's a financial, that's not a business model change. The business model change requires you to go plus your offering, go to the market with an uncommon offering. But if you're not providing peace of mind, frictionless relationship, simplicity, and convenience, then you're not offering subscription. But the real acid test is this: do the customers know they are subscribing to you? You and I know we are subscribers to Prime. We mm-hmm. know we subscribe to Netflix, Disney Plus, Hulu. Right. You know, if I park a Porsche Drive, I know I'm in a subscription relationship, not with their cars, but with Porsche. It's a different psychological relationship when you subscribe to mm-hmm. a company. And so no, I don't think a lot of firms that say they're doing subscription are doing it, not certainly not the way we are talking about, because if they ever mention scope, they're not doing subscription. Now, I'm not saying you couldn't have tiers, you couldn't still offer choices. I'm not convinced it needs to be three, by the way, which is another thing of value pricing that this blows apart. There are some tenets of value pricing that subscription blows apart. I've had to unlearn. And one of them mm-hmm. is, I don't think you need three choices. Now, that's absolute hearsay in value pricing. You always have to offer at least three, if not four, if you're more advanced, but you can never offer two. Well, I think you can offer two in subscription. I think you can even get away with one if you're narrowly focused and you stay in your lane and you're not doing all these one-off projects that are way out of the scope and probably your level of expertise. Then of course you can have one or just two options, but it's more about what's covered and not covered. So I'll give you a quick example of this. If you're a CPA firm and you do CAS work and you do tax work and you do advisory work, then you could have an option to say, we'll do everything for CAS that you need. Now that includes everything. There is no scope within that parameter.
Right.
If they need a report, if they want some cash flow projections, anything that you do within that parameter is covered when they need it. If they want us to do their taxes, they have to step up to the tax tier, and that includes everything that we do for tax. We handle notices if we do that. We handle IRS audits if we do that. We go to tax court and you need that, we'll do that as well. Whatever it is that we do in tax, in multi-state, whatever, Nexus, international even. And then if you do advisory, they can step up to advisory and they can start getting some transformations. Now, maybe they only want to do one transformation a year, because usually transformations are involved and they take a while. Fine, let them subscribe. Once the transformation's over, they want to slide back to the tax or the CAS option, let them slide back. It has to be completely frictionless. And by the way, they have to be able to cancel at any time. There's no lock-in. There's no upfront price to get started. No, that violates the spirit of subscription. Subscription is you sign up, you try it. If you don't like it, cancel. That's why Netflix and Amazon put the cancel button everywhere when they interact with us. In fact, Netflix went a step further. Netflix says, we have about 400,000 subscribers who pay us every month, and they haven't logged in for 6 months, 9 months, I think it was. We're going to cancel you people. Now, a cost accountant would tell you, that's insane. These people are paying, and they never access you. That's gold. What's better than that? That's terrible if you're a subscription business.
Right.
You want people to rely on you. You want people to value you and go to you when they need you. And you can't do that if they're not doing that. Then how can you guide a transformation? Netflix canceled them. Canceled 400,000 subscribers. This was a couple years ago. That's amazing. No business would do that. But they did it because they have a different mindset. If they're not using our product, they're not going to be good lifetime long customers. We're not building that customer relationship value that's so essential in subscription.
Yeah. Now one thing that the cancel anytime button brings up is pricing. You know, I can see CPA saying, well, you know, we did their tax return. You know, they subscribed to us in February. They got us all their documents. We got their tax return out in April. So that was, 4 months of payments they gave us, or 3 months of payments they gave us. And then May 1st, they cancel us. You know, so they're getting $1,200 or a year's worth of service for just three payments. So how do we price this?
Right. I love it because CPAs love to go to the worst case scenario. And that's not the worst case scenario I heard. I'll give you another one. But here's my answer to that. This isn't a pricing issue. This is a strategy issue and an onboarding issue. There's no way to value price the wrong client. There's no way to put the wrong client into a subscription relationship. The relationship is even more premier in subscription. And if you have any doubts about this client, because basically, Liz, all we've done is, you know, I'm a big proponent of the value guarantee. And that exposes you for a whole year. If the customer says, you know what, I think I only got $500 of value from you this year, and I paid you five, so I want $4,500 back. Under my value guarantee, you'd have to give it to them. Now, the new value guarantee in subscription is that cancel button. And that incents the customer to cancel. So you're going to learn about problems probably faster.
Right.
You got to trust your value. You've got to make an assessment about the customer. If they're the type of customer that you think is going to cancel after 3 months, after you've done this upfront project, or it's some cleanup work, or, you know, 7 years of prior taxes, or just indeed 1 year's tax return, then don't take them on. Say no. And if they do cancel you after 4 months, okay, they did you a huge favor. They self-identified as a pain in the butt. Let them go. Chances are you're not going to make that same mistake again. That's going to make you a little bit gun-shy before you start taking on clients. And because you're taking on fewer clients, there's less probability of that happening to begin with, because you've got fewer customers. The ones that get in feel special. It's a club. It's a membership. Membership has privileges. So I don't see that as a big issue. If that happens over and over, you've got a client selection problem. You're going after the wrong customers.
That's true. Now what about pricing models? You know, how does that work in a subscription model? In value pricing, you look at the value delivered, but for subscription, what is it?
It's a different profit formula. So you're looking at customer lifetime value. So you're modeling that. That's a model. It's also a very complicated model, by the way, because that's one thing that's not as settled as the KPIs, because it's a model. And, you know, there's some subjectivity about what you include in customer lifetime value. If you look at Andreessen, how the Andreessen Horowitz calculates it versus, say, how Subscribed Institute, you know, Teenzo's think tank, there's differences. And so, but we're CPAs, so, you know, we can figure that out. But the point is that we're no longer looking at the math of the moment. We're considering that lifetime value. So it's not about optimizing the price of the job or the profit on the job or the margin in any one given year. Our income statement forces us to think about the lifetime value and model that, because we're backing out churn and we're tracking annual recurring revenue. So the pricing, I think how firms should think about this is, once they define their focus, like if they do nothing but dentists or restaurants or contractors or whatever, take a look at the average price that you're charging now for customers. Now this gets weird, and this is going to vary by firm, but you take a small firm, 2-4 partner firm, and you look at their revenue spread. Have you ever done that? It's fascinating. They'll have some $500 customers, and they'll have $100,000 group, $100,000 customer, and everything in between. It's like, okay, you're probably going to have to get rid of one end or the other, because again, you're trying to be Morton's, McDonald's, and a vegan rest, and it's just not working. That's not a pricing issue. That's a strategy issue and a positioning issue, right? I can't sell Rolls Royces and Chevys out of the same dealer. And when you have a spread like that, you're trying to sell a $100,000 engagement to a guy, and this happened to one of my CPA buddies, and the guy looked at him and said, $100,000. He says, don't you do my brother-in-law's taxes for $500? Well, yeah, that's what happens when you go to the market with an incoherent strategy and positioning. So what he did was he took all of his CD customers, what we call cutting off the back of the airplane, and he moved it across the street, put a different brand on it, called it Express Tax, and had a different pricing strategy for those people. And he never had to touch those clients. He put an EA in charge of them, because it didn't require a CPA. You didn't want a surgeon piercing an ear. And that freed up capacity in the mothership CPA firm and allowed him to go after those 100,000, because that's where he wanted to live. He only had those customers because when he started out, he took all comers, which is never a good idea. It's always going to come back to bite you.
I would agree with you there. There are so many times when I did client work that I had no idea what I was doing, why we had said yes to this person. And inevitably, some of them did come back and bite us. So, yeah. Now, what are some possible ways that a firm could transition to a subscription model?
Great question. Oh, and one more thing on the pricing. The reason I talked about the spread, once you narrow that spread and say you take a look at your median price, your average price, I think with subscription, because you're going to the market with a plus offering, an uncommon offering, you multiply it by 2, 3, or 4. Just, this is what Howard Moran did with MD Squared. How did he come up with 24 grand a year? This is 1996. Let's run that through a real, nominal to real dollars. That's a huge number. And he got it. He filled up 50 and he had to hire another doc, and he filled him up real, and he had to hire, and that's how they spread across the entire country, because there was a huge demand for it. And he, I don't know how he set that price, but my guess is he said, well, it's going to be more than, 4 or 5 times what my average patient pays me now. So I think this gives you 2 to 6 times the pricing power that you have now. That freaks people out when I say it. But I will tell you, Liz, I would have paid my eye surgeon, I'll pay him $1,000 a month, or a, grand a year, 1200 grand or 12 grand a year, or I'm sorry, 1200 a year, say, or 2400 a year, just to know I can get into him when I need him. I just signed up for an HVAC subscription for $20 a month, because to get one of those guys out took me it was like 10-week lead time. Now that I'm a subscriber, 24-hour guaranteed they will be on my premises. I'll pay for that any day. Save the customer's time, give them convenience, and you will get pricing power. If your average price now is $2,000, you could probably get $6,000, $8,000, no problem. Especially if you combine it with doing transformations.
And what I'm hearing is that these firms that do a lot of those $500, $800, $1040s, they may lose some of those unless they can demonstrate to these customers that there is something they can offer that would be worth the extra money. Otherwise, those people will leave. And frankly, some of them, it's good riddance.
Right, right. And, you know, just one caveat, when we used to talk, you know, and everybody talks about this, you know, grade your customers A, B, C, D, and fire the C's and the D's. With one caveat, I would suggest, our customers aren't going to get better until we do. And maybe the reason your customer only spends $800 or $1,000 a year with you is because you've never brought to them anything else. You've never had deep, meaningful discussions about all the things that you could do for them that don't require stacking up services brick by brick and scope of work and change orders and all of this nonsense, but having just a relationship with them and saying, hey, we can help with that. And maybe they would become a more valuable A customer or B customer if they knew there was an opportunity to do that. And I put that onus on us before we get rid of them.
Absolutely. So back to my question. What are some methods for transitioning to this new model?
Right. And this is a great topic. I have a whole chapter in the book on this. There's essentially three models that you can look at, and that we have a lot of empirical evidence. A lot of this comes from Teen Zoe and his company Zora, because he's got thousands of customers in all different types of industries. They're able to, you know, aggregate this data and take a look at it. And they have people helping companies do this and pivot to subscription, because of course they're trying to sell them all their software, so they have every incentive. But there's three models. One is you start a new firm. You just spin out a new firm, because this is such a different mindset, because it requires a plus offering, because it's different pricing, different KPIs, different accounting. The income statement looks different because it requires a new mindset and no legacy system. I mean, there is no room here for timesheets. There is no room for tracking time or measuring things based on time or pricing based on time. And that, by the way, is the most successful model, according to Subscribes Institute, is when you spin out a new firm. Because if you think about it, it's really hard for a firm or any business to cannibalize itself. And that's what you're going for here. You're going to spin out this new firm. You're obviously going to invest more in that than the legacy firm. And over time, the new firm's going to grow and cannibalize the old one. That's the goal. The second model is where you do this gradually. You stick your toe in the water and say, oh, you know what? We're going to do subscription in CAS. Mm-hmm. Well, then you run into the same problem that you had with value pricing, moving from hourly to value pricing, because value pricing is such a customer-centric pricing strategy.
Right.
What if one side of your firm is billing by the hour and the other side is doing value, you know, giving a fixed price with payment terms and all that kind of thing? So that's not a good idea either. That's a mixed marketing and positioning method to the customer. So when you do a little experiment like that and you say, we're going to try this out, maybe with this tranche of customers or in this service line, well, okay, I will agree with you that that's a lower risk test. But lower risk means what?
Lower reward.
Lower returns, yes. And you're not committed to it. You don't have skin in the game as much. You say, yeah, see, we tried that and it didn't work. How many times have you heard that in a CPA, you know, partner meeting? Oh, we tried that during the Rutherford B. Hayes administration and it didn't work. I mean, sometimes I think partnerships that were good ideas go to die. The third model is what Adobe did. And Adobe took an enormous risk, and boy, did they upset their investors and shareholders at the time. They said, we're not going to sell software in a box anymore. We're going to put everything in the cloud, and we're not going to support software. We're not going to upgrade it. You're on your own if you use it. Good luck. I guess it's still being sold on eBay, that people still buy box software. I find that fascinating. But anyway, when they did that, It was a risky move. I mean, it was a risky move. They did that back in 11 or 14, I forget the year. But of course, they're thriving. Enough so where they just bought another company called Figma. And this is a great story. $24 billion they paid for Figma, which had annual recurring revenue of $400 million. What's the multiple on that? So when we talk about annual recurring revenue coming in at a higher multiple than recurring revenue, because that's how an investor is going to look at a firm. It's going to put your revenue into two buckets. And the annual recurring revenue bucket is going to be a hell of a lot more valuable from a multiple standpoint. You know, John Warlow from Canada, he wrote that book, Built to Sell, and he's got a big database of businesses selling, including a lot of professional firms. He says, we're seeing 5, 6, 7, 11 times multiple
for
subscription business, not one. Sometimes we see two with value pricing, three, seeing a heck of a lot more, because it's predictable revenue. You're not starting on the 0-yard line every day like you do with recurring, reoccurring revenue. You're starting on the 50-yard line. It's more predictable and it's more valuable. And people and investors are screaming at the market, we're going to pay more for a subscription. That's why so many unicorns are subscription-based. That's how they get those high valuations. They have that annual, that's why everybody seeks the holy grail of annual recurring revenue. But we kind of already have it, although it would be classified reoccurring. But if we invested in the relationship more, if we actually aligned our business model with our rhetoric that we're a relationship business, then I think our exit price would be much higher. And that needs to be factored into the profit formula. We can't just look at the bottom line. We have to factor in the growth of the value of the firm as well, because that's going to affect your exit.
Right. And I think that thinking about the exit strategy is really going to be a pain point now and for the next few years as these older baby boomer owners are looking to retire and sell. And here they've got a firm that nobody wants to buy.
Including the people who work in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't want to buy the firm that I was working in. I didn't want to buy any of the firms that I was working in. I thought that they were terrible businesses.
Yeah. They're a job more than a business. Yep. So yeah, the other thing is people push back on this too, that it's not scalable. You know, you can't scale. Well, look, I think it's a challenge to scale a business under any model, you know, whether you're hourly billing or value pricing. I mean, value pricing doesn't demand or guarantee that you're going to be able to scale. But I will say this, with subscription, like Dr. Paul Thomas from Detroit, this direct primary care that we've interviewed four times on our show, when he started right out of residency with DPC because he never wanted to go for the fee-for-service treadmill. He said, that's not why I became a doctor. So he started up his own little practice. He didn't even have a PA, Liz. He had nobody. It was just him. He grew to 600. He brought on another doctor. He grew them to 600. Brought on another. He's got three doctors working for him now. He's about to open up a second office and put two more doctors in. So he's been able to scale. This is in the 4 years since we've known him, 4 or 5 years. He's been able to scale, but it's at an organic pace. You know, he's not going out and acquiring other DPC practices, although I guess he could, but he's doing, because there's such a demand for these doctors. Why? Because it's an uncommon offering. Because I can get in to see Dr. Paul tomorrow and I don't have to wait 5 months like I do with my eye surgeon. That's why.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think, like you, that the accounting profession is ripe for change and revolution and disruption. Now, is there anything else that you would want the listeners of this podcast to know? You know, besides going out and buying this book.
I think when I think about, and I learned this from studying TQS and going to Disney University and kind of immersing myself and by benchmarking on Nordstrom and L.L. Bean and all these great companies, the one thing that really stuck with me was we compete against any business, any organization actually, that has the capacity of raising our customers' expectations. Mm-hmm. So when customers interact with your firm, whether that's belly button to belly button or digitally through your portal, through your website, on their phone, apps that you use, whatever, what they're comparing that experience, that entire experience to, is Amazon. Mm-hmm. I click on Amazon, one click, it shows up sometimes same day. I guess I'm in one of those cities. sometimes the next day. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And I've never talked to anybody at Amazon, by the way, which I also find is very interesting because talk about relationships. Mm-hmm. Have you ever spoken to anybody at Amazon? I mean, maybe the driver you say hi to or what. I think I called Kindle tech support once and they were great, but I don't have a relationship with anybody inside of Amazon. And yet they've raised my expectations. And so we don't just compete against other CPA firms. We compete against any entity that has the ability to raise customer expectations. And if your customers subscribe to a DPC doc, talk to anybody who subscribes to either Concierge Doc or a DPC Doc. I promise you, they are raving lunatic fans. They rave about their doctor. They rave about the experience. I can text him. He replies within 10 minutes. I can send a picture of my kid's rash, and he'll tell me what to do about it, if I should worry about it. He can prevent me from going to the ER. All of these things, that's what we're being compared with. We need to up our game as a profession. Average net promoter score in the accounting profession? 23. Apple, 78, 80 something. BMW, Porsche in the 80s. Liz, we need to up our game. Our customer experience is awful in this profession.
Yes.
And I think it's because we have too many customers. Mm-hmm. I don't care how good you think you are, mm-hmm, or how big your firm is, how many people you have working for you. And here's the most heretical thing I'll say, relationships don't scale. They don't scale. No. You know, it's the Dunbar number. We can only accommodate so many people. Now, I'm not saying businesses that are based on relationships can't scale. That's not what I'm saying. Paul's scaling, but Dr. Paul himself can only handle so many relationships. And maybe at some point he's even got to relinquish those and step back and work on his business rather than just, you know, being involved in it. But that choice is, you know, lifestyle firm versus I want to grow to a big firm, whatever. I mean, that's going to vary, but relationships don't scale. Let's start to recognize that. Let's start to recognize that it's not about the tech stack. It's not about the apps. It's about the relationships. And again, track the time that your customers spend with you. Because I think a lot of firms, because of this technology, have said, well, the less time we have to interact with them, the better off we are. We can just, you know, we have more capacity. No, it's not about getting more capacity.
No.
It's about having spare capacity for the people you're privileged to serve, so I don't have to wait 5 months to see my eye doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And besides being a better customer experience, it also makes it a better employee experience.
Yeah, we're not burning out our people. I don't think we burn out our people as much as we rust them out because we're not giving them challenging work. Again, it's that surgeon piercing ears, and I've always been bothered by that, and I still see way too much of it.
Yep, I would agree with you there. I think that was part of what drove me out of public accounting, that I was still doing the same things
year after year. Sometimes on the same day, right? You'd open up the file and go, oh, Jesus, this is exactly what I was doing on this day last year. Sally, right? Yep.
Exactly. Well, Ron, I think we could go on and talk about this forever because you and I are on the same page with this. Now, if listeners want to connect with you, what's the best place to find you?
Great question. I'm on Twitter at Ronald Baker. I have to use Ronald J on my books because it's such a common name, right?
Yeah.
There's so many other authors out there when you search Amazon. But I'm at Ronald Baker on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm one of LinkedIn's influencers. So I have over 100 posts up there on topics of pricing and marketing and subscription and DPC docs and all sorts of other things. The best way to get us is through thesoulofenterprise.com, our radio show that is live every Friday, and then it drops to any podcast player that you may use. And we've interviewed Dr. Paul on that show 4 times. We've also interviewed, by the way, the 4 top leading authors in subscription, and in my mind, and that is Teen Zoe from Subscribed, his book Subscribed, and Robbie Kelman Baxter. She wrote The Forever Transaction and The Membership Economy. Ann Janzer, who wrote Services or Subscription Marketing. And John Warlow, who wrote The Automatic Customer. And of course, his great book, Built to Sell, How to Position Your Firm to Sell It. So we have those four leading authors. Then we've talked to CPAs like Jody Grunden from Summit CPA, who runs a subscription-based business and grew it from 600,000 to 11 million. So he talks about his journey. And we've talked to lawyers who are using subscription. And and we have a bunch of shows that Ed and I have just done on subscription, how it differs from value pricing. By the way, another question we always get is, what if I'm using hourly billing right now? Do I have to go through value pricing or can I just jump right to subscription? I believe you can jump, because going to value pricing first is only going to give you a legacy system that you're going to have to unlearn.
Right.
So why go through the process of learning if you can just jump over, just like some countries did, you know, when they didn't have to have a landline, they just jump from having no phone to cellular, and they didn't have to install, you know, telephone poles and wires. They just jumped. Same thing here. I think you can jump. So the Soul of Enterprise is the best thing to do. And if people want, they can go to thesoulofenterprise.com/timesup and they can join our community of people who are interested in taking this further and discussing it and sharing information and ideas and best practices amongst themselves. So we have quite a little community of people that are very interested in this model. And you can find, there's extra benefits from joining that as well. So you can find out more at thesoulofenterprise.com/timesup.
Thank you so much. And it's just been a great honor having you here. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much, Liz. Thanks for having me. I had a great time, great conversation, great questions, by the way.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPATrendlines.com, now available on iTunes. We hope you'll rate and review us wherever you find your podcasts to help other accountants find our show more easily. For more information, you can go to CPATrendlines.com.